delivery services to save money, forcing FedEx to cut costs. It's already removed aircraft from its fleet. Express ships around 3.5 million packages on an average day. The services division includes FedEx Office, the former Kinko's. FedEx says it hasn't decided how many employees will get the buyout offer, but the company warns the troubled global economic picture will slow its earnings through next year. Janine Herbst, NPR News, Washington.
And earlier we reported that Google's Motorola Mobility is also slashing jobs, about 4,000. Japan's economy has grown by much slower than expected, 0.3% in the second quarter. It reflects in part the sharp increase in the yen's value and slower exports. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Ally Bank, who believes smart listening and smart banking go together. Learn more about Ally Bank at allybank.com.
Support comes from Wesley Church and Wesley Foundation at Green and Goodwin. Free Connect gatherings and dinner for new grad students, faculty, and community members with information on area resources held August 17th. Worship services Sunday at 9:30 and 11:15 a.m. Details at wesleyui.org.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. It's hour two of the show. The following program comes from the Focus Archives, which means for the next hour, we will not be taking your calls.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. In the affluent industrial societies of the world today, life is good. Most people live long lives without fear of plague, famine, or war. So why is it that there seems to be fairly significant amounts of depression and anxiety and unfulfilled longing? In short, why has abundance not led to greater happiness? That is the question that we will discuss this morning in this hour of Focus, and our guest is historian Peter Stearns. He's provost and university professor at George Mason University, and he is the author of a book that we'll be talking about. The title of his book is Satisfaction Not Guaranteed, Dilemmas of Progress in Modern Society. It is published by the New York University Press. It, in part, takes a look at some of the ways that people in the past thought about progress and asks whether we can be truly happy in the modern world. And Professor Stearns, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
I was told by producer Harriet Williamson that you grew up in Urbana.
I did indeed, 202 West Vermont Street.
Wow, and you must have been an academic family?
Yes, my father was an historian also.
Oh, very good. The acorn didn't fall too far from the tree there.
Right? I guess not.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it. I'm not quite sure where to plunge in here. Maybe you're just with the basic jumping off point that some people at least, scholars at least, if you go back maybe a couple of hundred years or so, as people thought about the future, they had this general idea that as we learned more and as technology developed, that in many ways life would get better and better, and that as a result, people would be happy or would be happier.
Right.
And so the question is, as we look around us, it seems that, you know, there's a fair amount of dissatisfaction. And the question is, given that that kind of improvement in life really did happen, why is it that we're not happier?
Right. Well, you know, there are a variety of factors in play. The first thing to say is there is evidence that with the various gains that modern conditions bring, happiness does go up some. Mm. The issue is it doesn't go up as much as one might expect, as much as the optimists 200 years ago predicted, and it may actually plateau after a while so that more modern gains don't produce further results. So there are some interesting questions wrapped up here. And the issues are several. One, obviously, modern conditions also produce some new problems, so that automatically dampens happiness to some extent. Two, modern conditions, even some of the ones that produce gains, have some complexities, and it's hard to figure out how to react to them, particularly since we're still fairly new to the process. Mm-hmm. And then finally, when you get gains, human beings being what they are, A, you sort of forget what conditions were like in the past, so your gratitude dissipates, and B, expectations start going up. Well, we have all this, we should have more. And that makes that creates a situation where more than a bit of dissatisfaction can creep in.
Yeah, and when I guess when we're talking about the benefits of modernity, we are talking about things like, generally speaking, peace, prosperity, greater levels of education, longer lifespan. You know, the fact that generally people, we don't see a lot of people dying before the age of 10, we don't see women dying in childbirth. There are all sorts of things. And then some benefits of technology, which also has its downside. But all of that is what's wrapped up in this package. And I guess I found myself thinking, I don't know if it's too early in the conversation to ask a question like this, but I did find myself thinking, is there a price to be paid? You know, yes, there are. All, you can say these things have made life better in a lot of ways, but is some amount of dissatisfaction, depression, anxiety, neurosis, all very modern ideas, is that some of that the price we have to pay?
Well, some of it, some of the extremes are. I mean, there really is evidence. It's a complicated topic, but there really is evidence that levels of depression go up in modern as opposed to pre-modern societies. So for a minority of people, but an important minority, anxiety levels do increase to a level of positive illness. So that is a price. I think for more people, it's not so much that there's a massive price to be paid, but things just don't get as much better as one might expect.
Hmm. Well, given that psychology, as we know it today, is, well, it seems to me, essentially it's a 19th century invention, and that some of the words that we have to describe psychological pain and dysfunction are relatively new. You know, having said all that, what really do we know about the happiness of people in the past? And, you know, for example, is there any way to say something, ask a question like, or answer a question like, well, were people in the Middle Ages happy?
The answer is probably yes, but your question is aptly posed. They probably would not have been able to respond to a question about happiness. The concept was not as lively, and they would have thought more in terms of happiness in the next life, a certain degree of humility in this life. So as far as we know, they actually were quite likely happy in some cases. A lot depends on personality in any society, any time. But the framing of happiness is something that's developed, particularly in Western society, over the past couple hundred years.
Hmm. Maybe we could talk a little bit more about, as scholars use the term modern or modernity, it's something we toss around rather casually, but I think probably for historians, for example, it has a rather more specific meaning. So when you talk about modern, what exactly does that mean to you?
Well, you sort of captured it already. You're talking about a process that, if not at the outset, at least fairly quickly, would produce a predominantly industrial rather than agricultural society. You're talking about growing levels of urbanization, ultimately to the point where the agricultural population diminishes to well under half. You're talking about improvements in consumer standards. You're talking about improvements in life expectancy. It's a package that begins to develop in Western society in the later 18th century.
Mm-hmm. And is increasing the fact that society is increasingly secular and has more of a, maybe more of a scientific or technological kind of approach to big questions, is that an important part of it?
Well, yes, but it's a variable. So you do get increasing secularism. Certainly the importance of science increases in all the so-called modern societies, but degrees of secularism vary. The United States, for example, is a quintessentially modern society, but religious values run fairly high. So there's no set general point about the degree of religious decline. Some changes in the position of religion, yes. Absolute uniformity, no.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, let me just quickly introduce, is Peter Stearns. He's provost and university professor at George Mason University. He's the author of many books. Some of the ideas here that we're discussing this morning you will find in his recent book, which is titled Satisfaction Not Guaranteed, Dilemmas of Progress in Modern Society. It's published by the New York University Press, and indeed looks at this question Why is it that while we can say in so many ways that our lives are better today than, say, the lives of people 100 or 200 years ago, why is it that it seems that there's a lot of dissatisfaction with life, at least if what we're talking about here are modern, industrial, affluent countries? 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And email, that's a possibility too. You want to send in your thought that way. And that is will-talk, so W-I-L-L-talk at illinois.edu. How is it that you came to this question? This I know it fits in with generally your kind of interest as an historian, but maybe you can talk a little bit more about how you even come to it.
Sure. Well, it does result from two angles. One is, as an historian, I've worked on a number of the specific topics that I try to address in the book, like changes in the modern conditions for children, changes in the modern conditions for consumers. So a batch of specific topics I've worked up historically and feel I have some basis for talking about the complexities of modern change in these categories. But I've also really been interested in the recent wave of fascination with happiness, the various international polls that try to measure happiness or mental conditions like depression. And it's just impressive that the rank order of societies by happiness does not correlate all that closely with degrees of modernity, though there is a relationship. So I approach it from that angle, too. I'm very interested not just in the history for its own sake, but history as it helps us understand present dilemmas.
Could one point to a particular time when people really started talking more about happiness as something that was a kind of entitlement, and that it was something that they as individuals were really, that there was this expectation that they as individuals would have it?
Well, yeah, I mean, part of the answer is pretty easy. The happiness notion that we still live with was born in the 18th century, and people began, in some cases, to develop a sense of entitlement or expectation, hence, in the American Revolution, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness as a sense of right. I think a wider sense, a wider public sense that you should be happy, probably didn't fully develop until the 20th century, where you get a much wider sense, for example, when you think about children, that children are supposed to be happy as a birthright of childhood. That's something that's more recent. But we've had a couple centuries to play with this notion.
How much do you think this has to do with, and maybe this is something that's a distinctly American notion, this strong emergence of the idea of individualism, the importance of the individual, and in the fact that maybe people stop thinking quite so much about family, community, those larger frames, but people have a greater and greater tendency to think about what is good for me, what I am entitled to as an individual, and that even, you know, institutions like marriage, for example, that in the past were very much about regulating society, at some point really become about more actually about personal happiness, which okay. It seems to me that's actually a pretty significant kind of change.
Yeah, that's a good question, and I do think you're right in implying that the Western notion of happiness was associated with a growing sense of individualism. The measurements of happiness were in many ways individual, but it's a complicated topic because even today, if you ask most Americans, what's the category of life that makes you most happy? They will say family. Mm-hmm. And so I wouldn't make it individual versus family community. I would make it more individual and family as against larger mm-hmm. community structures. Because one of the changes is, in fact, we start measuring marriage by whether it makes us happy or not. Now, it's an individual measurement, but it's attached to a relationship, so it makes it more complicated than just individualism. Mm-hmm.
We have a caller. Let's bring them into the conversation. Someone who is in Champaign and on our line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Very interesting show. Very thoughtful. I had just a couple of comments. I'm guessing a little bit of what your guest is talking about might be the case of the diminishing returns. I don't think a lot of people have to worry today about, you know, eating food and health and such like that. But, you know, if you compare yourself to others, and I think that might be the great fault here, or maybe compare your situation, financial, whatever, maybe to 4 or 5 years ago, then I don't know if that comes into play or not. And I think that could be a very slippery slope. But I look at it also, too, in a wider sense, the difference in the family structure. A lot of people are having babies out of wedlock, a lot of single parents. Children are left on their own without too much structure, more so than before. And my sense is that the kids are growing up with diminished expectations, you know, just kind of getting by and society as a whole, you know, a lot of people might say, well, we don't see ourselves moving forward. In fact, if you compare back to maybe the 60s or the 50s, you know, there are a lot of changes, you know, crime, unemployment, poverty. And I think that might come into play. Certainly, it's a problem we can enjoy, if that's the right sense, because, you know, we're not back in the 1700s and the 1800s. We're just living to 25 and 30 was a feat unto itself. But I think it's the quality of it, the individual life, that might come into play here. And I'll offer that up for discussion. Thanks.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks. Good comment. A couple reactions. First of all, obviously, the current economic crisis puts a particular take on this whole issue. My book, and I hope my book is still relevant, my book was not based on trying to fathom the current crisis, which obviously produces very important specific reactions. Also, one has to recognize that there are categories like the single parent, the growth of poverty. These are issues that are undeniably important in assessing modern life. But I would take issue with a couple points. For example, there was at least an implicit assumption that with modern conditions, crime goes up. That's actually not, for the most part, true. Crime has been going down. One of the interesting aspects of the modern U.S. is we tend to assume crime goes up when it's not. So there are some facets here that I think have attached to the happiness proposition that are more complicated than simply noting some of our really important social problems or the current economic crisis.
All right. Again, I thank the caller for the thoughts. Anybody else would like to offer thoughts, ask questions, be a part of the conversation. It's easy to do. Just call us, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455, or you may send an email to will-talk@illinois.edu. I mentioned a couple of times the subtitle of the book, which has the word progress in it. When did the notion of progress, as we think about it now, when did that come into being?
Oh, that's very definitely an 18th century notion. Associated with the Enlightenment, the notion that all sorts of things could change in life in this world. Enlightenment optimists, and there were varying degrees of optimism, but Enlightenment optimists thought that you could create greater abundance, that you could beat back death. They were fascinated, for example, with examples of long life. They thought that children's lives could improve with education. The basic progress package was born about 250 years ago. I don't think we believe in it quite as much as used to be the case, mm-hmm. but it still has a pretty strong grip on us.
Yeah, there seemed to be this idea that there was that life was a hill to be climbed, and that we do that, and that whether you're talking about culture, you're talking about the economy, you're talking about individuals and their life, or you're talking about the species as a whole, there always was this idea that this wasn't just a flat linear journey.
That's right. No, it was
climbing, that we're always going up somehow.
At least once you have the basic Enlightenment understanding of what life is about. And the vision of progress included some stuff that, for the most part, we've now dropped off. For example, a strong belief that progress would include elimination of war. We've sort of dropped that part of the vision.
Hmm. How much do you think the problem here we're talking about has it has something to do with our tendency, and it's something that I know people are aware of and concerned about and recognize as being a problem, but it's our tendency to measure well-being with material goods.
Well, it's an important part of the equation, obviously, and the 18th century idea of progress did include a preliminary vision of improved levels of abundance. I think we clearly have invested a great deal of our sense of personal measurement and societal measurement in terms of improvement in consumer standards. And frankly, without meaning to editorialize, pretty clearly we've overdone it. We actually know pretty definitely that improvements in consumer standards will lift levels of happiness for a while, but once you reach a certain level, more consumerism does not generate more happiness. Indeed, it may begin to press on a downward slope.
Hmm. Was there a time when the idea that the idea came about that personal happiness, or maybe the expression of personal happiness, that is, how did a person seem to be a positive person or a negative person? Were they generally positive in their affect, or were they melancholic? Was there some point at which it became problematic if you were a down person,
and
somehow
great
that, you know, the idea was that if you're happy, that was the norm, and if you weren't happy, well, that something was wrong with you.
Yeah. Again, I don't want to beat a historical horse here unduly, but this begins to emerge in the 18th century also, increasing recommendations that a proper person would display a cheerful demeanor. One historian has argued that one of the factors here was improvements in dentistry, which improved the quality of teeth such that people became more eager to smile. This has been a fairly steady drumbeat, and there is actually pretty good evidence that Americans carried this particularly far. By the early 19th century, foreign travelers were noting that Americans really tried to insist on being cheerful to a point that they just they found somewhat hard to comprehend. And then the cheerfulness pressure definitely escalated further in the 20th century. So that, we expect people to be cheerful. We don't like too much melancholy. We don't like too much grief. And we are impatient with sadness to a point that's probably counterproductive.
Mm. We have another caller here, someone who is on cell phone. We'll get them right in, and that's on line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I apologize about the call quality. I'm on my vehicle on a hands-free thing, which doesn't always work too well. I missed the first part of the show, which I apologize. I just wondered, do we have a definition of what happiness actually is? Is it simply an absence of misery? Does happiness vary with the time period? I mean, how do we define happiness? What is it? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
I thank you for the question.
Great question, which I'm tempted to try to duck. Yeah, the definition of happiness varies with probably the individual, certainly the time period and the culture. We've discussed on this show already some elements of what I think would be a standard American definition of happiness, a strong degree of individual component rather than communal solidarity, probably a strong element of material well-being, but I would add a certain sense of positive emotionality, a sense that goes beyond simply consumer levels or individual measurements, so that there's a feeling of inner joy, at least periodically, an emotional state that goes beyond material circumstances.
Hmm. That is one of the big questions here that the caller raises, and particularly appropriate question as we're trying to wrestle with this idea of, well, are we happy? What does that mean? How does our state of, I mean, if we say we're happy, does that mean the same thing that someone said, you know, in ancient Rome or in the Middle Ages or any other place when they said they were happy? Well, does that mean the same thing? All of that gets really difficult to wrap your arms around.
Absolutely. And again, there are cultural differences even in our own time. When you do these international happiness polls, modern Asian societies tend to express lower levels of happiness than modern Western societies. I'm not convinced that's because they're less happy. I really believe that it probably reflects mainly a different definition, a less individualistic sense of how to measure this animal, rather than really measurably different levels, if we could get some sort of absolute determination of the phenomenon. Mm.
I suppose that one would, if you were of a slightly cynical bent and you reflected on all of this concern about happiness, you'd say, well, you know, we'd be unhappy if we didn't have something to worry about, and that we have this sort of obsession with measuring things and ranking things and figuring out where we are relative to other people. Why this... this concern with happiness?
Well, again, we've been told for quite a while now that somehow part of our assessment of our individual identity, mm-hmm. and certainly our social identity, should be generated by some sense of whether we're happy or not. So we've been told for a long time, we're told as kids, that we're supposed to be happy. So we have quite a bit of conditioning going into this. And then I think also, and here there is some particular reference to the current economic situation, I think some societies are groping for measurements of the human condition that go beyond the standard economic determinants. And I, up to a point, that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. So you have the nation of Bhutan trying to measure happiness rather than just GDP levels, and you have movements in France and England to try to measure happiness as a better indicator of how society is doing than the cruder economic determinants.
Well, let us talk with another caller here, someone in Urbana. This is line number one. Hello.
Hello. Earlier, one of the callers made some remarks upon what I suppose I'd call social disintegration. And one of them was the number of children at present being born out of wedlock, and that this, he thought, was much larger now than formerly. And it seems to me he's perhaps missing the point. Certainly, marriage was a very important aspect of middle-class life in the 18th and 19th centuries, but when you examine the working class, and particularly the poor part of the working class in this country and in England, and I think, although I'm less familiar with the situation in the rest of Europe, the lowest class was very deprived, that I'm quite sure that there was a very high incidence of children being born out of wedlock because most of the families couldn't afford marriage. And I think that there are two factors in the situation today. There are lower class and working class people who find it difficult to afford marriage, in part perhaps because of the inordinate expense of a wedding at the present day, but also because of the number of people that are just barely getting by. The other aspect is, I think there is in this country, and more so in Europe, decreasing influence of formal religion. Would you care to comment?
Yeah, well, I mean, good points for the most part. I think probably there has been an increase in, for example, single-parented, which the previous caller referred to, but you're absolutely right. Not a brand-new phenomenon. There were strong pressures toward relatively high rates of illegitimacy in 19th century industrial societies. So a complicated but good caveat. Some of the current social issues that we need to attend to are certainly not brand new. I also agree, though this is much more common in countries like France and Sweden, I also agree that some relatively stable relationships form without benefit of marriage. Much less true in the U.S., but it seems to be gaining ground in the younger generation to some extent. So simply saying that a child is born out of wedlock is not necessarily a meaningful statement. It may or may not mean a single-parent situation, an unstable family situation. Complicated issues, so I agree with you.
There's always a problem with oversimplification, I think, and I hope I haven't been too guilty of it.
Yes, it's a constant problem. If we couldn't oversimplify a little bit, we probably couldn't say anything at all. So there's an obvious tension here.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. We're talking this morning in this hour of Focus with Peter Stearns. He's a provost and university professor at George Mason University. He's the author of the book, Satisfaction Not Guaranteed. We'll talk some more in just a moment after a short break. This is Focus.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Green, America's big-time battery innovator, A123, got millions in taxpayer support. Now China's snatched up the company and its knowledge. What's wrong with this picture? Plus, Ken Pureney made millions forging famous works of art. Now he tells all. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Tonight from 9 to 11 on AM 580.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of a previous Focus program. As this conversation is pre-recorded, we're not taking phone calls today. This is Focus.
And in this hour of the show, we are talking with Peter Stearns. He's an historian at George Mason University, author of many books, including this one here. We're talking about Satisfaction Not Guaranteed, Dilemmas of Progress in Modern Society, and it's published by New York University Press. I think we explained, or maybe we didn't, that perhaps one of the things that you're interested in as an historian is how it is that people over time have tried to adjust to the changes that come with modernization. So that would be things like the big move from urban to rural and the move from being agricultural as your focus to, say, maybe working in a factory as your focus and different ideas about how people live. So you're interested in how people cope with those kinds of changes. And if we think of the modern age really as only, maybe we're only been in it for a couple of centuries, then maybe the question comes, so how long do you think it takes for people to really cope with the kind of, and considering also that the pace of change still feels very rapid and can be very dislocating.
Sure. And obviously, we get additional changes added into the basic modern changes, so it is a complicated topic. Well, if I knew exactly how long it would take, I'd try to bottle it. I don't. I think that one of the things I try to do in the book is indicate that some of the first jolts of modernity produced reactions that we're still coping with, but we've actually learned how to do a little bit better. Let me use an example. The first reaction in Western society to modernity was to argue that you needed to increase the differentiation between men and women. Men should be out working. Women should stay home. Didn't apply to everybody, but it was a dominant social scheme. This was not, in the long run, a useful reaction. In fact, modernity reduces some of the key differences between men and women as education gets further emphasized, as the birth rate goes down. So a first reaction was misleading. We're still coping with the aftermath, but we've learned or are learning to do a good bit better in this category. I'd like to think we can do that in some of the other categories also. Mm.
Here's a question that has come in over the email. I don't know how you might reflect on this. Someone who just poses this question, what connection is there, if any, between age and happiness?
All I can do here is reproduce what I think are common current polling results. Older people tend to be happier than younger people, at least currently. Some of this may have to do with specific current conditions where unemployment levels are higher in the younger age group. Some of it may have to do with broader patterns in life. But there are age category differences, and they're quite interesting. I wish I knew more about them historically. I don't know as much as I would like, but the differentiation is certainly intriguing.
Hmm. I wonder, to what extent if this dissatisfaction, or maybe a better kind of word would be uneasiness, in us today, it has something to do with uncertainty and not being quite sure how our lives are going to go. And I guess one could imagine that in the past, particularly if you were born into a place where there was the socioeconomic order was rigid, and you might have a pretty good idea what your life was going to be like. And now, one really doesn't know.
Yeah, that's a good point, and up to a point I agree with you. I mean, certainly in traditional societies, pre-modern societies, far more people could pretty much expect to be doing what their parents did. By some standards, this is a bit of a bummer, but it did provide a certain degree of predictability that we've lost. I would like to think that for most people, the uncertainty is challenging and even exciting, but it has an anxiety downside, no question about it. Now, we've gotten rid of some other anxieties. We're much less likely to have to worry about famines and starving to death. So it's a different balance. But certainly the point you make in terms of predictable personal futures, that's a good point.
Mm-hmm. To another caller here, someone in Aurora. This is our line number 4. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Yes, you just made a statement about older. Where does older start?
Over 50.
Okay. Well, I'm well past that mark. Okay.
I hope you're happy.
Well, you know, when I found that I'm at that time in my life where I'm kind of content and more concerned about enjoying the next 20 years if I have that many years left, rather than worrying about some of the little things, but one of the things I did want to call though is I have found that this is a blanket statement, but as far as my fellow American, it seems like the more they have, the more they want, and the more they want, the less they appreciate what they have.
Well, up to a point, and I have a chapter on consumerism in the book. Up to a point, I agree with you. I do think we've, particularly in the U.S., I mean, it's to some extent true of all modern societies, but particularly in the U.S., we've chained ourselves to a sort of constant set of rising expectations that can be really counterproductive. We're sort of on a treadmill. So I think this is an area where we need some rethinking. The current economic downturn may actually promote some rethinking and be a slight silver lining in an otherwise big cloud, but some reassessment is desirable.
Mm-hmm. Because, I know someone, and I won't be too specific, but if they had $1 million, they'd want two. If they had two, they'd want five. If they had five, they'd want ten, so on and so forth. You know, they're just not content with what they have.
Yep, yeah. Yep. And you know, we have a lot of pressures that encourage this, including advertising pressures. Advertising depends on trying to make us feel that we don't quite have enough already.
Because, they have like a 6-bedroom home for 5 people and 5 cars at one time for 4 licensed drivers and a TV screen that's like sitting in the front row of a movie theater, and it just, and they're still not happy.
Right. Yeah, well, we have pretty good evidence. It's an old bit of wisdom, but pretty good evidence that after a certain point, additional money will not bring additional happiness. Up to a point, it does. And presumably in the U.S., it's about $75,000 a year. Mm. Up to that point, the more money you get, the happier you are. After that point, doesn't make much difference.
That's interesting. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much for the call. Myself, I think $5 million would be plenty.
That's very, very restrained.
That would be good. Let's go on to another caller here. Urbana, line number 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, this is a very interesting discussion, and I like to bring out something that would indicate some complexity in some of our modern ideas. In this society in particular, actually, I think in this time of economic downturn, in some ways, I'm happier than I was in the '80s. When my husband and I were raising our children, and we didn't realize this was in the time of Ronald Reagan, and supposedly there was this wonderful prosperity, and we didn't realize that really the bottoms had been pulled out for, or you know, the the rug had been pulled out from under the middle class, which we were. And we found that our dollar wouldn't stretch very far, and we were getting taxed more, and we were under a lot of economic stress. At the same time, if, you know, our kids would watch television and they would see these examples of people living in a lot of luxury that was kind of supposedly middle class. You know, whereas I feel like at the time, people like me who truly were middle class were fairly miserable because there was this very shaming feeling that we should have more than we have. We should be doing better than we are. Everything was kind of gilded back then, you know.
Right.
And so I find myself now feeling a lot more content, because I feel like my society around me isn't going insane with consumerism, and I don't feel the shame of not being able to provide all this unnecessary stuff.
Right. Well, obviously, that's an interesting point, and you and I agree that there are aspects of an economic slowdown that can cause people to reassess their goals. Obviously, some groups in this economic downturn are positively miserable. We have an increase in poverty rate that we need to pay real attention to. But for some people outside that group, there are some opportunities to calm down a little bit. I would agree with you.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. And again, other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I'm struck by the fact that the last two callers have both used the word content.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if this is making too fine a distinction, although that's what we'd like to do at the university, make fine distinctions. Whether there's an important distinction to be made between saying that I am happy and saying that I am content.
Yeah, I would agree with you, and good observation. And I sort of cheat in the book. The title is, after all, not about happiness. The term in the title is satisfaction. Mm. That also may not be quite the same thing. Yeah, contentment doesn't imply contentment's a great state, so I'm not criticizing it at all. But it doesn't quite imply quite such an active sense of emotional upsurge that I think happiness does. Good point.
Maybe now that we're at this point where people are very concerned, particularly because of what's been happening economically the last couple of years, and just, you know, recently in the news there have been these stories about in the last couple of years just how many individuals have lost big chunks of their personal wealth. And I think it wasn't just in the last couple of years. It goes back here more than that. We have a lot of people talking about what's happened to this expectation that children will do better than their parents?
Yeah.
I think we lost that before 2007. So it all, again, to me, suggests this question. Do we, in fact, still believe in progress? Does that, in the way that they use the term in the Enlightenment, does that really mean anything?
Well, look, I think it's, again, a great question. I think the reaction, my reaction would be mixed. We still hang on to some elements of it.
Mm-hmm.
We still, for example, think that if we throw more scientific research at cancer, we'll be able to beat cancer, or at least reduce it. So I think in some areas, like health, we continue to expect greater progress. I think with regard to children and family, we're probably more cautious, and several callers have already suggested that in some of these areas we may legitimately think that things were better sometime in the past than they are now. So I think our vision of progress, quite apart from the current economic crisis, our vision of progress is more mixed than the most extreme Enlightenment view was 200 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we have another caller here on our toll-free to go there, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
And I think I must state that happiness is really more of a Zen sort of thing for me. You can be rich, you can be poor, you can be fat, you can be thin, you can be beautiful, you can be ugly, tall, short. It's really a personal inner thing that you acquire with being able to just come to terms with yourself. Personally, for me, happiness would be another 30 years of Mr. Inge talking to me on the radio, but I'm sure that's not his idea of happiness, though. So what would you like to say about that?
Well, I wouldn't dispute that at all. Happiness is obviously a very personal item, and different people are going to define it differently, and I wouldn't dispute your definition at all. And I thought Mr. Inge did say he would do this if you paid him $5 million.
Oh, he did.
Oh, you know, now that you mention it, yeah, we could talk about that.
I wish I had $5 million, Mr. Inge.
Well, so do I.
Take care.
Thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And again, if you're interested in sending in something by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, where I find this whole conversation entertaining and fascinating and diverting, where are we now at going through all this for you in thinking about these things? Where are we on this question about? Well, obviously we know that there is this dissatisfaction, and we kind of have some ideas about why. But do you feel that you have any better understanding of this, having grappled with this for a while?
Yeah, I mean, I would argue, yes, I do a little bit. Not trying to tout my wisdom excessively. Really, the point of the book, there are a couple, two or three key points in the book, I think. But one of them is there are areas where if we simply thought about our goals in relation to modern conditions a little more clearly, thought, for example, about consumer pressures a little bit more clearly, we might be able to come to more positive terms with some of the stresses of modernity than we currently do. I have arguments in the chapter on parenting and children where I repeat similar notions. I don't think we're going to get some sort of magic improvement, but I think we could reduce anxiety and improve contentment, if not happiness, a little more with a bit more understanding and some adjustments in certain reactions to modern conditions. So a moderate plea for understanding and stepping back. I think it's really important not to see all of modern conditions as somehow simply inevitable. They can be adjusted to human needs more clearly than we sometimes have done in these first 200 years of the process.
Well, to another caller over in Indiana here on our line number 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Yes.
Hi.
Yes, this is Janet McVeigh.
Yes.
And I'm a Quaker. And just wanted a very interesting program, and some of the Quaker beliefs are in simplicity and peace, and that really, to me, works into what you're talking about, and you know, contentment.
I think that's a good observation, and. I very much respect the insights that Quakerism provides on this topic.
Well, thank you. And you know, the whole thought behind not trying to acquire more and more, and there's a, for one thing, a wonderful small organization, Right Sharing of World Resources, which is based on the ones of us that have plenty. Providing through this organization for some of the poorest of the poor. And, you know, it's one of many ways to embody our beliefs and pass along being able to live a decent life and being content with what we have right here.
Right, and I would add, consistent with what I think you're saying, there's no small amount of evidence, and many Americans realize this quite actively, there's no small amount of evidence to say one of the ways to acquire happiness is by doing good for other people.
Right. Very, very true. So anyway, I've really enjoyed listening to this program, and right here at the end thought, oh my goodness, I ought to say something about the fact that, you know, our group tries to embody appreciation for what we have and passing along some of the benefits that we have.
Well, and can I just ask you, does that something that you feel, did that come easily to you, or is that something that you actually had to work at?
Oh, I was brought up by my mother very much brought me up this way.
Mm-hmm.
She was not a Quaker, but no, it came very naturally. And when I realized what Quakers stood for, I thought, ah, I finally found the group I'm looking for.
Yeah, very good. Well, thanks for calling in and talking about it with us.
You bet.
We appreciate it. We're coming down to about have a minute or so left. You know, when I was an undergraduate, I had a buddy who, one of his mottos was, and I think he said this only half jokingly, he used to say, always expect the worst, you'll never be disappointed. And I guess it does make me think about some of the concerns people have raised about depression and sadness and, you know, how much sadness is normal and at what point do you treat sadness and do we expect, are we expecting people to be happier than it is normal for them to be? I mean, do we have an odd way of balancing this normal dynamic of happy and sad in people's lives and want to kind of write the sadness out?
Well, look, two quick thoughts. One, yes, I think without much question, we probably would benefit by learning to tolerate sadness more fully. We don't handle it well, at least in others, and I think we should learn to do better. And then a related theme that runs through a good bit of what we've been talking about, there really is considerable evidence that if you put too much pressure on yourself or your society to be happy, you will end up being less happy than you would have been otherwise.
Mm. And is this a particularly American preoccupation, all of this, or are the other people in France and Italy and Germany and Britain really wrestling with the same stuff?
There are other people wrestling with the same thing, but I think we have some particularly acute pressures in the U.S. because we've carried the happiness culture to extremes in certain ways that make us particularly vulnerable.
Many interesting ideas in this book. If people would like to read it, once again, the book is titled Satisfaction Not Guaranteed, Dilemmas of Progress in Modern Society by our guest Peter Stearns. It's published by New York University Press. Peter Stearns is provost and university professor at George Mason University. And thanks very much for giving us some of your time.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local production, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the Subaru Impreza, with standard all-wheel drive and an EPA highway rating of 36 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at SubaruofChampaign.com or at their location on Route 45 in Savoy.
Coming up on tomorrow's Focus in the 10 o'clock hour of the program, a conversation with Gretchen Morgenson, assistant business and financial editor from the New York Times, about her book, Reckless Endangerment, How Outsized Ambition, Greed, and Corruption Led to Economic Armageddon. It's a rebroadcast from June of 2011. Then in the 11 o'clock hour of the program, we'll hear a conversation with journalist Ananda Rose, author of Showdown in the Sonoran Desert, Religion, Law, and the Immigration Controversy. On Wednesday, in the first hour of the program, we'll listen back to a conversation from June of this year with Jonathan Haidt, professor of ethical leadership at the Stern School of Business at New York University, author of The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. Then in the 11 o'clock hour, a conversation about how grassroots community action and 21st century technologies can empower elders among us to stay in their homes and lead healthier, happier lives. The guest, Dr. Alan Teal, is a family physician, and he specializes in geriatric medicine and wrote a book called Alone and Invisible No More, addressing that particular topic. That's what's coming up on Focus in the next couple of days. The Afternoon Magazine is coming up next. Among the stories we're following at this hour, United Airlines says it's moving its corporate headquarters into Chicago's Willis Tower. Also, an enrollment event at Provena Covenant Medical Center in Urbana this afternoon provides a second opportunity for people seeking alternatives to health care benefits that they lost due to recent state budget cuts. And the Indiana State Fair will come to a standstill tonight on the one-year anniversary of a fatal stage collapse. Also in the next hour, a conversation with Kent Redfield, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Illinois at Springfield, about political endorsements. There have been a number of them within the 13th District Congressional race in recent weeks. The question is, do endorsements really matter? That's just some of the things that we'll have for you in the coming hour here on the Afternoon Magazine. Stay with us. Let's update you now on the commodity market, starting with Kansas City wheat for September at 876 and three quarters, down 16 and a quarter. December wheat at 901, down 16 and one quarter. Chicago wheat for September is at 871 and a quarter, down 14. December wheat at 888 and a half, down 12 and three quarters. September corn is trading at 792 and a half, down 7 and a half. December corn at 801, down 8 and a quarter. March 2013 corn at 804 and a quarter, down 7 and 3 quarters. And May corn at 799 and 3 quarters, down 7 and a half. August soybeans trading at 1672, down 37 and a half. September beans at 1634 and 3 quarters, down 38 and a half. November beans at 1609 and a half, down 34 and a quarter. And January 2013 soybeans at 1603 and a quarter, down 32 and a quarter.